tonight on Arena. Maxine Peake on her new English Civil War film and its parallels with today's England, and Conor Hanratty on Shakespeare in Japan.
+51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Later this week, the new film from Thomas Clay, Fanny Lai Delivered, will be released across digital platforms. The film tells the story of Fanny Lai, a housewife leading a pious family life with her husband and son in mid-17th century Cromwellian England. And into this pious rural life, two naked strangers arrive, awakening something hidden deep inside Fanny's character. The film is described as a folk horror, and I'm delighted to say that its star, Maxine Peake, joins me now on the line. Tell me a little bit more about the character of Fanny Lai, Maxine, as you see her, and what drew you to her?
I suppose it was her journey. You know, this was a woman's journey through, you know, through emancipation. She starts off what you think, you know, as a victim, which I don't believe she is for a second, but she's very controlled by her husband, by, you know, the patriarchy of the time. And it's about her awakening, sort of physical and sort of intellectual, really, throughout the film. And for me, it was also the time period. I'm a big sort of fan of the English Civil War, of the English Civil War that we're not really taught about at school, the levellers and the diggers and the ranters and, you know, the sort of grassroots, the sort of people's revolution, you know, that was sort of happening at the time, this new progressive world that was opening up. So that was, you know, the first sort of tick in the box. So, yeah.
And certainly the position of women in 17th century society anywhere, but particularly in the puritanical society in Britain of that time, very hard to, I would have thought, have any kind of feminist bone within your body. Or perhaps if you had a feminist bone, you'd be staying very quiet about it. How much did that, you know, the feminist heart at the very centre of the film, how much did that attract you?
Yes, very much so. And I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think women, women have always felt the injustice and, you know, they felt that, obviously, feminist stirrings, but there's nothing you can do with it. There's nowhere you can go with it. So it's when somebody has to put a lid on that, you know, a deep, deep, that gets buried very deep. You know, I'm sure women of that period had the same thoughts and feelings, but there was no way they could act upon it, or the majority couldn't, because survival meant a partner, husband, you know, like I say, the patriarchy, and especially it's in that puritanical time. But that really did, you know, really appeal to me, because it's a universal story, and it's an age-old story. And unfortunately, it isn't a story that has ended with the modern day. It still continues globally and to, you know, a bigger and lesser extent in this country. People are still very much, you know, in relationships, you know. But I think Fanny was very much a representation of the women of that time.
And another thing I think is worth mentioning is when the husband, her husband, John Lai, as played by Charles Dance, when you have somebody who is going to enforce his will the way he does, as we see at one point in the film, very disturbingly, something goes wrong with his son. His son misbehaves, and it's his son and Fanny who get caned very badly by him when that happens. That's a frightening situation.
Well, I think that's not, you know, I don't think it was an unusual situation at that time. That's the discipline and it, you know, the responsibility put on the wife, on the female, in that it was somehow her fault that the son was being willful or just being a child.
Yeah.
You know, disciplinary sort of standards were shocking. But yeah, it was... It's that thing that becomes very normalised, I suppose, in her existence. That was what was to be expected. And she knew that was coming. That was the whole fear, you know. She knew if a son did engage with these two in throwing the Winberries, I think, around the outside, there would be serious repercussions.
Things change enormously, however, with the arrival of Thomas Ashbery, as played by Freddie Fox, and Rebecca Henshaw, as played by Tanya Reynolds. They bring a very different energy. They arrive naked into the film. They bring a different energy.
Well, they're the high attainers, so they're part of the sort of, as they were called, ranters. They were the sect, sort of, you know, there was many different groups that split off, and they were, you know, I mean, people describing the sort of the prototype hippie, you know, it was very much free love. So they come in with this sort of new way of thinking, this very progressive way of thinking that blasts everything, you know, the foundations of sort of Fanny's existence, you know, religion and the piety. And but it's interesting because I think, you know, she sees them initially as this ball of energy, this new, you know, door onto a new world, but soon very quickly realizes that Thomas is just another cog in the patriarchy wheel, that he's a man who's got a very high opinion of himself, likes to hear his own voice, and realizes that, you know, that's not where she's going to find her freedom. It's through herself. It's about self-realization and self-emancipation.
To what extent does the character of Rebecca, as played by Tanya Reynolds, help Fanny perhaps see that possibility, that self-realization and self-emancipation is a possibility, given, even though Rebecca is in a difficult relationship with Thomas herself, but she shows her maybe a different way of thinking that doesn't involve suppression of desire in particular?
Yeah, and I think there is that. But I think as well what Rebecca shows her as well is that actually, for all that, Rebecca is still in a relationship that does feel in some way controlled, that the man is still in charge. And I think part of Fanny's sort of desire to get out of there, and she takes Rebecca with her, is that there's a young woman who, I suppose, she sees is going to go down the same track. I think there's an opening, and I think it stirs feelings within Fanny Lai, but I don't think she knows they and their beliefs are not the answer for her. And I think she actually feels some sort of protection over Rebecca, that she's sort of being lied to as well, in a way. They're all being lied to by these men about how they should behave. And I think that kicks something off, that she's, you just got to get out then. There is freedom out there, and you can, she's going to give it a go on her own and see what the, you know, the outcome is.
It's such a misfortune befell you two. It gives me the shivers. We'll get by like we always do. Don't you worry about me. Have you no family you can go home to? Help you out in your hour of need? I will. I suppose Mr. Ashby's your master now.
Thomas ain't my master. No man is. I go where I likes with whom I likes.
I don't think I understand. So you and Mr. Thomas, you be not. Why, that means you must be living in sin. And you afraid?
Afraid of what? The size of his member?
Afraid of hell, young lady. Of fiery hell and torment. And not to mention the law. And such talk. Oh, my. The devil will set upon you with furious industry, my poor sweet girl.
You'll not tell your husband, I hope. I thought we were speaking in confidence.
I must consider your eternal soul. I have to believe it's never too late for a sinner. Mr. Lai could help you on the path to righteousness. I do believe so.
I don't need no righteousness. Mrs. Lai, I beg you, don't bring us no more trouble and woe.
I suppose so.
Rebecca Henshaw, as played by Tanya Reynolds, and the character of Fanny Lai, as played by Maxine Peake, in the film Fanny Lai Delivered. Maxine Peake speaking with me this evening. The period in which the film is set, Maxine, is very interesting in and of itself. But how does that period, that 17th century Cromwellian Republican England, how does it speak to the type of cultural wars, the type of situation in today's Britain?
Well, it was a real revolution, wasn't it? You know, saying about the one of the, I think, the most detailed books on the period about the sort of grassroots, about the people's sort of revolution is Christopher Hill's World Turned Upside Down. And it's in the title, isn't it? You know, this was, there was a new progressive wave of politics coming through, but this was coming from the ordinary people. They were taking back the power. It was revolutionaries. You know, you've got Gerard Winstanley, who was the leader of the Diggers, who actually came from up the road near me in Wigan. there was new ways of thinking and new possibilities. And it feels very, it's feeding into where we are today. You know, things are being exploded. You know, it feels there's something in the air at the moment. And obviously with the horrendous incidents that have been, that have happened in America, and, you know, been, you know, it's nothing new, is it? But we've come to a point when something's got to give. And it's not just America, it's in this country we're accountable. It's globally, you know, we need to take a look at ourselves. And I think that's, it feels like something's happening. There feels like there's a sort of hint of revolution, whatever, what size of revolution that is, but that people have, that change is coming. And this was a big period of change for so many people, and so many possibilities felt like they were being laid out for people.
You sound optimistic, cautiously optimistic, but optimistic nonetheless. Can the arts and have a role in that kind of change, do you think? What's it like for you now being an artist in what you're saying is a very changing, not just Britain, but a changing globe?
Yeah, of course. I think, you know, as humans, we need food, we need drink, you know, but we also, we're storytellers, aren't we? That's the whole thing. We need stories. We need not only to hear other people's stories, which is extremely important. And I think that's where the arts has a real play, I suppose. But it's also who's allowed to tell those stories, because everyone needs a witness. We all need someone to hear us. You know, that's, I think as humans, that's all we all crave, isn't it? Someone to feel that we matter, and that somebody's listening to us and somebody respects us. And when you can see those stories that reflect back at you, it can be life-changing. Also, when you see stories that don't, you think reflect your experience in life, but actually show you somebody else's experience and that you can learn from that. So I think we have there's a big shift has got to happen within the arts. Yeah, it's about people having access to other people's stories and people having access to be able to tell their stories.
Can that happen in the current political climate? I mean, you were a supporter very much of Jeremy Corbyn. You campaigned with him on many occasions. In the state that Britain is in now, an amazing 12 months really when you think of it, amazing few years when you think of how things have been changing and how volatile things have been. Are you optimistic that that kind of change can happen within that scenario?
With this present government, British, I'm not confident they'll help the change. But there's a point when, I suppose it's what happened in just after the English Civil War, that the people decided to, you know, take it into their own hands and go, well, if change is not going to happen from on high, we're going to have to do something about it. And whether it is, you know, people setting up collectives, people coming together, and, you know, and it's support and it's about finance. If you're not going to get it from the government, then it's setting up schemes where people can support and help people to get into whatever job or industry you want to go into. But it's not just about that. I think for things to change, of course, we need a change of government. But we had our chance and we messed that up. But anyway, another 4 years.
During the pandemic, you made an extraordinary short film, in fact, for the UK-based domestic violence support agency, Refuge. Tell me a little bit about that film, how it came about.
Well, that came about, years ago, I did a BBC drama called Criminal Justice, which was about a woman who'd been suffering long-term abuse from her husband. And at the beginning of the drama, you see a killer husband, and then the story is it's not who done it, it's why she did it. And, you know, on paper, she's got this perfect, what seems middle-class life, you know, beautiful house, husband is a barrister. And part of the research, I went to meet them at Refuge, Lisa King at Refuge, and spoke to her about, you know, And then I got a call from a director that I'd worked with, Steve Reeves. I'd done an independent film called Keeping Rosie. And he said, I believe, you know, you know them at Refuge. And I've been asked to direct a short film about, you know, about obviously that domestic abuse is on the rise in lockdown. You know, it's escalating at the rate of knots. And would you be interested? And I said, yes, of course I would.
Alex. Oh, where are you?
Hello, Richard.
You're right. You've been gone since yesterday morning. I've been worried sick. I've been calling non-stop.
I know. I'm okay. You don't have to worry about me.
So where the hell are you? We're supposed to be in lockdown. It's not safe to be out. You need to be at home.
Richard, that's not going to happen.
I don't even know where... What?
I'm not coming home anymore.
What do you mean?
I'm not coming home. I've left you.
Why? Where did this come from? Is there someone else?
No.
Then why? Where are you, anyway?
It doesn't matter.
Well, it does to me. Who is he?
I've told you there is no one.
So where are you?
Please, don't ask me again, or I will hang up.
For Christ's sake.
And we did it, you know, on Zoom with a brilliant Let Shrapnel. Steve said, you know, can he suggest a brilliant actor? And I went, I've got my mate Lex, I'll give him a ring. So he said, of course, I'd love to do it. So we, and because we knew each other and we've been friends for, so it was, you know, we're over Zoom. Mm. We did it over Zoom and our phones clipped to our laptops. So it was a strange process. And I think it was, you know, a great bunch of people. So it was very much you film and then you download and then you send. So it was a very odd way of doing things. But I mean, I just thought it was such a great thing to be involved in, you know.
Lots of things happening in odd ways. Obviously, you're talking to us about Finally Lie Delivered, which is going to be released digitally. That's not the worst thing in the world in terms of film. What about theatre, where, you know, that live experience, sitting in an open space, looking at somebody up on the stage in front of you? We hear lots of concern about, will big companies, important companies, will they survive this period? What are your feelings around the possibilities and the problems for theatre at this time?
Well, it's frightening. It's scary, scary times, you know, and you've got people like Cameron McIntosh saying, I'm going to close my theatres and they won't be open until next year, you know, and it's not just the people on the stage. It's the people behind the scenes. It's the people in the offices. It's the people in the front of the house. It's, you know, it's a huge industry. It's devastating. And how do you come back from that? And I wish I had some answers. And, you know, and I know there's lots of qualified people out there who are really, you know, people are really working to find, you know, solutions to this. But it's scary times, I think, for theatres. And, you know, theatres are going into receivership and, you know, smaller companies especially, that, you know, some companies won't come back from this, which is really, really sad, you know. You know, it breaks my heart because you think some of these West End companies, they've made millions and millions. I mean, who am I to say, but maybe they could look after the staff better. But anyway, you know, I don't know the ins and outs and I'm not an accountant, but, you know, it seems people need support. Mm. And I think, I don't know what the future is for theatre. I'm hopeful, of course, it will bounce back, but there'll be some people, that some companies, some theatres, you know, that just won't be able to come back from this. And that's heartbreaking.
Thanks very much for speaking with us this evening, Maxine.
Thank you.
That's Maxine Peake, and Maxine's film, Finally Lie Delivered, will be released across digital platforms in the UK and Ireland on this Thursday, the 26th of June.
I Know Alone, the title of that track from I Am. That's from their new album due out later this week, and one of three that we'll be reviewing on Friday night's programme. Conor Hanratty was a teenager in 1990s Dublin when he watched an Open University documentary that sowed the seeds for the professional life he now pursues. He's just written a book in the Arden Shakespeare in the Theatre series where he looks at productions of Shakespeare's plays by the Japanese master Yukio Ninagawa. And that links us right back to Conor's teenage epiphany. He joins me now on the line to tell me more about Japanese theatre. But first of all, the teenage epiphany. Let's find out more about that. Conor, what did you watch in the 1990s that had such a profound effect on you?
Well, my enterprising mother managed very late one night to record an Open University documentary about Greek tragedy. This is the stuff of which geeks are made, I think. There was footage within that of a Japanese production. I think they were kind of showing it in the hope of giving a sense of what Greek tragedy might have sounded in another language, because we only know it in English, of course. And I saw this footage and it changed my life. I decided to study Greek in school, and then I studied drama in university, and I directed Medea myself while I was there. And then I managed to convince the Japanese embassy in Dublin to give me a scholarship to go to Tokyo and hunt that man down and try and work with him.
And that man was Yukio.
That's right, Ninagawa himself.
Now, just to stay slightly for a little bit on that moment of watching the Open University documentary as a teenager, did your mother, you know, force you down into the sofa to watch this? Or was this the type of thing that you were constantly doing? Please let me watch the Open University documentary, Mom.
She was a teacher, and so she was a magpie. So she'd kind of spot things and store them up every so often. And sometimes she would share them and sort of say, have a look at that now, you might like that. Mm. And more fool her, I did. it was an amazing production that drew kind of on Japanese theatre. It was the production that brought him to Europe to a greater or lesser extent. Obviously, he was a Japanese director working on Japanese things for Japanese audiences, but it toured to the Edinburgh Festival. And one rainy night there in the middle of August, as nights in Edinburgh tend to be, a wonderful producer called Thelma Holt saw the show, and she decided that this needed to be seen by more people. So she brought Ninagawa to the National Theatre in London in a double bill, the Medea and his production of Macbeth. And history was made for about 20 years after that. Every single year he brought some kind of a production to London or to Europe after that, thanks to her.
And many of them productions of Shakespeare's plays. Sadly, by the way, your mother is no longer with us. I presume she got to see the start of this career, but the book is dedicated to her, but she didn't get to see the book, obviously. When did you lose her?
She died in 2009, so I was back from Japan a little bit by then. She didn't get to see the book. She would have been brilliant at proofreading it, I'm sure. But she did at least. She got to see a production that he directed in Stratford when he was invited by the Royal Shakespeare Company. My parents came over, and Rough Magic's Seeds programme sent me and some of my fellow Seeds all over to see it. I don't know if some of them have forgiven me yet, but we had a great time.
Okay. Now, tell us more then about this style of theatre that Ninagawa gives us, particularly around Shakespeare. I'm interested in the fact that the first Shakespeare play he was asked to do was Romeo and Juliet. And if I got this right, I was listening to one of your podcasts earlier on today. I'll come back to those podcasts. It was an entertainment conglomerate in Japan that asked him to do this production of Romeo and Juliet. Now, what kind of entertainment conglomerate are we talking about? Were we looking for a loud and brash version of Romeo and Juliet, or what was being sought?
Very much so. He was the kind of enfant terrible at the end of the 1960s. He directed really political, angry plays. And Tokyo in the late 1960s was fomenting with a lot of anger for various reasons. So he was this kind of brash young headliner. And the company that was responsible for inventing Godzilla, that's how big we're talking, came to him and said, a young producer within that company spotted him and said, do you know what, let's get him. And he came in and he directed Romeo and Juliet. In a way, he had seen Peter Brook, he had seen Trevor Nunn, both of whom toured to Japan with very interesting contemporary productions, and he thought, surely we should be able to do that in a Japanese way. So he put loads of Elton John music in the play, he put them in modern dress, young people running around constantly on the stage. So until then in Japan, Shakespeare had been quite formal. Ironically, like, he only came to Japan in the 19th century, but already he was part of the canon. He was to be respected and formal, and there was the way to do things. And instead, here were loads of people running around shouting, multiple levels, like really carnival atmosphere. So he was very much the breath of fresh air. And it went well enough that he didn't return from the commercial theatre at all for the rest of his career.
So his productions of Shakespeare were considered part of the commercial theatre very much rather than any kind of classic formalism that was involved. It sounds like a kind of a Baz Luhrmann style.
That kind of energy. Yeah, like it was that exciting. What Baz Luhrmann did to the movie, it was a comparable moment. His theatre was commercial, not necessarily in like a glitzy musical Disney kind of a way, so much as they were big and they sold in big houses and they had big ticket prices, but people came to see them, and he had this provocative energy and this kind of zeal to do things in a way that Japanese people would connect to it that never left him. And he was constantly messing with stuff. I mean, he directed Hamlet 8 times in 8 different ways over the course of his career. That's the kind of questing spirit we were dealing with.
And those 8 different productions of Hamlet, it was often that the actors who would play the part of the prince would either were big stars or went on to become big stars and big movie stars in some cases.
Very big movie stars, yeah. Like the 2 of the guys who both played Hamlet for him wound up in that Tom Cruise film, The Last Samurai. One of them, Ken Watanabe, I think he's been nominated for an Oscar, but he's had a very big movie career since he learned English. And he was in some Christopher Nolan movies, like a really wonderful actor. Nearly every actor worth his or her salt in Japan went through at least one Ninagawa production.
And did he, you say he gave us 8 different productions of Hamlet, 8 very different styles of production. So there, you can't say there is a Ninagawa style and that's the way he does everything, or can you?
Well, there was an approach, shall we say. Like, he always tried to make things accessible to a Japanese audience. So if there was a convenient way that he could frame a piece or use the Japanese cultural image or icon that would be a means of telling the story, he would use that. But it was never the same kind of thing. And also he got bored, so he didn't want to do the same thing. So some of the Hamlet productions were big, huge shows with like a cast of nearly 100 people playing all of the Danish court. And then he did another one towards the end of his career that was with a bunch of young actors that he was trying to train. So, and it was much, much smaller. So the scale might have changed. There were some particular stylish things. He loved red. So people wearing red clothes and red, big red robes would always be like, he wanted to train as a painter, and he wasn't good enough to get into the university that he tried for. So he became a director instead. So there was certainly a visual flair that was always there.
And are we always, in the case of the Japanese productions, are we always talking about Shakespeare in translation?
Yes. Everything was done through Japanese. He worked towards the end, the second half of his career, with a female translator who is on course to be only the 3rd person ever to translate the complete works into Japanese. But she, being a late 20th, early 21st century female academic, has had a really interesting way of bringing out a feminism in the works, the way that the Japanese language works and so on. So in some respects, they're contemporary plays.
What then? I think there was one of the productions of Hamlet in particular, which Ninagawa reckoned was the Everest, I think, not just of Shakespeare, but perhaps of all theatre. It was the Everest play, I think he referred to it as. There was one that was in English with quite well-known English actors involved, but I don't think it was that well received, was it?
This is the kind of paradox with his work. When he did things that were super Japanese, people really loved them. Maybe there was Orientalism or kind of the clouding or the seduction of the imagery. But when he worked in English, it never went as well. He did a production of Peer Gynt, he did King Lear and the Hamlet that you mentioned, all in English. And perhaps because there wasn't the kind of film across things in terms of how the language was working and the sound of that people were seldom as impressed or as interested.
And the big Hamlet that had the English players, give me some of the actors that were involved there, very recognisable names.
Michael Maloney, who is a terrific, kind of, I won't call him a jobbing actor because that sounds pejorative, but like a really, really strong journeyman performer. Our own Frances Tumulty was in it as Gertrude. And two of the stars, I think, from the recent drama on the BBC, Giri Haji, that's now on Netflix, the lead guy in that was actually in it as the player queen.
Ah, the player queen. Yeah, player so queen, this, yes. This gives us a sense of the kind of gender is very fluid in a Nina Gawa production, I'm guessing. Sexuality, I'm presuming, is a very open book as well.
Well, certainly gender. Japanese theatre is rooted in very long traditions of all-male performance. So while he was never one to say he wouldn't be directing a no play by any means, but all of the codes and the kind of traditions of that stuff were ripe to manipulate and make plays more interesting. And, you know, Shakespeare was an all-male theatre. Greek tragedy was all-male. So his productions of those kind of things would draw on, you know, similarities in Japanese theatre as well.
I'm talking about Hamlet here, and I can't talk about Hamlet without mentioning your own Hamlet podcast, which was something. When did you start? That was back in 2017, am I right?
That's or right, earlier? August 2017.
August 2017. I think you're at episode number 137 or thereabouts at the moment.
Thereabouts, indeed.
You take about 20 lines of the play and give us the podcast that I listen to. They're all in around the 11, 12 minute mark. Thank you for not going on for 28, 30, 40 minutes on any 20 lines.
Oh, I think less is more.
But even 11 or 12 minutes on 20 lines, clearly Hamlet is a play for you that, you know, you can continue to mine ad nauseum, perhaps.
Ad infinitum, shall we say.
Oh, that's a much better term. Thank you.
There we go. I was always fascinated by the fact that my mentor had such a strong draw for the play that I didn't quite feel myself. I was always curious that, you know, Hamlet was the one, and I was not possessed with any kind of directorial desire to go and direct it. And I wondered why. So then in a quiet period, as we call it, back in 2017, I kind of thought, well, let's find out. Inspired very much by Frank Delaney's amazing Rejoice podcast that he was working his way through Ulysses. I kind of thought, oh, if I were to do that, what would I do? So I had to go with Hamlet. And here we are. There's about a year more to go with it. But the whole play will end in July of next year.
And each episode really working in that 20 lines or there. So, but one you do some extra episodes as well. I think at the end of each scene, you give us a kind of a supplementary podcast, one of which was about Nina Gawa. A recent one, perhaps. Yeah, I think you say at the very beginning of it, you didn't expect to make this podcast around race and casting in particular, and casting blindly or perhaps casting against colour or ignoring colour when it came to the play Hamlet in particular.
Yeah, last weekend there was a rather ugly piece of journalism that was criticising the Royal Shakespeare Company for ethnically diverse casting, and that just struck a nerve because it seems at this time, with everything that's been going on in the world for the last number of weeks, particularly deaf to, you know, read the room, for heaven's sake. And thinking about that, and then last weekend, the Royal Shakespeare Company production of Hamlet from a few years ago that had a majority black cast was on. And I wound up chatting a little bit online with the guy who played Hamlet because he decided to be open and be on Twitter and respond to people, which was amazing.
Who is he? Who was the actor?
His name is Papa Essiadu, an incredible young actor. And just it had been on my mind that what on earth does Hamlet or does Shakespeare have to do with the current moment? And I don't have an answer to that question, goodness knows. But I wanted to just have a look at what it means for a person of colour to play the role.
Finally, a year's time, you'll be finished the Hamlet podcasts, which they appear every Sunday, I believe, is your day of publication.
That's correct.
What Irish play will you be casting your eyes over, or would you have an Irish playwright or play that you'd like to approach in the podcast manner that you've done with Hamlet?
Well, I have a little plan, but it's not all confirmed yet, so I won't say. But do keep an eye and an ear open for something actually Os Gaeilge, which will be coming up pretty soon.
Ah. Right. Well, we have to watch out for that. Okay. Os Gaeilge, a podcast. Well, you have me enthralled, Conor Hanratty. I'll be listening out and watching out for that. I hope you'll tell us about it when the time comes.
In the meantime,
yeah, thanks for speaking to us this evening, Conor. That's Conor Hanratty. He was speaking to us about his latest publication, part of the Shakespeare in the Theatre series from the Arden Shakespeare. Shakespeare in the Theatre, Yukiya Ninagawa, is published by Bloomsbury.
It's not Chile, it's not Chilala, not hard pill to swallow. Chile or Chilea, Chia, Chilla, Dilla, that's not my name. Say my name.
Chila. Denise Chila, that's your name, and Chila is the name of your song. But you don't say it once during your 3 minutes and 44 seconds, Denise. You give us all the wrong pronunciations, not the right one even once. But you can hear her give us the right pronunciation and talk about how lots of Irish people have to deal with bad pronunciations of their name. If you watch Other Voices, Courage, that's this Thursday on RTÉ Television, 11:30 p.m. Latest installment of the show sees that up-and-coming Limerick-based rapper and spoken word artist, Denise Chila, supported by fellow rapper and collaborator God Knows, as well as Sean Murray and DJ Replay, all giving a mesmerising performance in the beautiful location of the National Gallery of Ireland. I saw a little bit of the performance earlier and it looks great. 11:30 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday night, Other Voices, Courage. Live Collision International Festival is a live art festival that, like many others, had to take the decision in March to postpone its live festival dates. However, the festival is now inviting audiences to celebrate its 2020 programme through a digital rendering called Electric Dreams, the festival that never was. To tell me more, I'm joined now by the director, Lynette Moran, whose name I think is straightforward enough, and Karen Miano, M-I-A-N-O. I hope that's the pronunciation that is correct of your name, Karen, and that you won't be writing a song about it in a few weeks' time.
Yeah, no, that's the correct pronunciation.
Good, that's good to hear. Lynette, I'll start with you. When you have a title like Live Collision International Festival, obviously the live aspect was very important and is very important to the festival. How big a disappointment was it when you had to postpone in March?
Hi, Sean, how you doing? Yeah, of course it came as a great disappointment, as you just said, as it did to many people across the art sector, having to cancel things at a very last minute. But of course it was really necessary for the protection of the artists and our audiences as well. So it was a necessary evil, let's say. And I suppose something that we were in a fortunate position really as a festival, because our festival programme has spanned since its inception across performance and digital platforms. So we had a precedent there of how work was shared with audiences beyond the live moment. So we were lucky to be able to kind of reimagine quickly and come together with our festival artists to create new offerings for our audience.
And I guess just because something is in digital mode, it doesn't mean that it's not live. We can have live interaction in digital mode as well, can't we?
Well, precisely, yeah. And then the interconnection between both digital and performance is often a way that, you know, artists making really interesting work have much broader reach with audiences beyond the amount of people that can fit into small spaces and so on. And of course, there's a number of things that we present in the festival that move beyond traditional performance settings. So, for example, we have a number of publications, live broadcasts, podcast series, and a lot of work as well that engages different modes such as VR and streamed performances as well. So there's quite a hybrid of ways that audiences experience the live work.
And that title, Electric Dreams, I presume, a reference to Together in Electric Dreams from Phil Oakley and Giorgio Moroder. The together bit is important there, that just because we may be at a remove physically, we don't have to be totally disconnected.
Well, exactly. And that's it. And I guess, you know, for anyone who's been to a festival that they really love, or anyone who's experienced a festival, you know, the whole energy of the festival is about people coming together, as you say. And it's about, you know, kind of spending 3, 4, 5 days together in this, in concepts, ideas and energy. And that's really what makes a festival great. So I guess we were really reluctant to lose that collectiveness and togetherness, which is the reason why we kind of worked hard to reimagine and how the festival could continue to have those moments of togetherness outside of the kind of mode that we were used to presenting the festival in.
Karen, then, before lockdown, what had you got in mind for the live piece? What was going to be the live festival back in March? How far down the road were you in developing that?
So we had had, I say we, myself, sorry, in facilitator mode. So I had done one sort of test run in A4 Art Sounds of a shorter version of about 14 minutes. And
a shorter, just explain what the piece was that you had okay. in mind at that time.
Yeah, so at that time we were doing Run a New Show under New Roots, which was kind of meant to be this sort of ethereal vibe with like sourced fabric. So it's a sonic piece ranging from about 15 to 30 minutes, which is now looking like 45 minutes because the more I sit on it, the more it kind of elaborates and grows into something else. But I was really interested in the idea of rest in public spaces. So the idea would be that you go into a space, you turn off your phone or you put your phone on silent mode, you listen to this sonic piece that kind of takes you on a journey and you come out of it the other end. So there was going to be smoke machines and bean bags and rugs and different textured sort of like cushions and fabrics. So it was all meant to be quite dreamy. But yeah, we're now pretty far along.
Yeah. And as you say, it was going to be 12 or 15 minutes somewhere in that region when you were developing it first, but now it's looking a lot longer. But just bring me back to that title, Wren in Utero. Give me the translation again and tell us how that feeds into what you're doing.
So I think from a personal perspective, there's been a lot of like change in my life. So I kind of, I guess if you want to say like came out quite late in life, and being a Black queer non-binary person as well, I felt like there was a reintroduction to my body. About I'd say 2 years ago, I started playing around with Ableton, which if you don't know, it's like a software. It's like a music software that you can download. So I started playing around with Ableton, and that was mostly for DJing purposes. And then also to give a bit of context, I guess, and the background of my work. So I also co-founded a collective called Origins Ella, which is a POC LGBTQIA plus community, which I founded to center queer Black lives. And our main objectives are congregation, celebration, and conversation. And these take shape in the form of dinners, panels, and parties for like the said community. So it was important to me, especially as we are at this point now in culture in Ireland, of finding our kins and finding our spaces and our voices as Black queer people within Ireland. So naturally, from that perspective, I've gone on to create a work that kind of has the same values. I don't know whether you've ever heard of this sort of idea or theory of I guess, like being time poor.
Yeah, I've certainly heard of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt it, you know, as well.
Yeah, so just the commute into work, and we've all felt it for sure, but the commute into work and that sort of trying to reclaim time. And there's this amazing, I want to say like the inspiration for all of this kind of came from the Nap Ministry, which are an online platform that just talk about Black rest, because obviously, you know, a whole plethora of things come into making this piece. And I, at the time, kind of rediscovering my body, rediscovering my who I was and where I kind of sat in society, you know, it was a lot of sort of sitting back and resting on it and allowing myself to become who I am naturally. So I like got rid of Instagram for a very long time, got rid of all the sort of outsider influences to re-find myself. But that is a privilege in itself, isn't it? To have that time and to have that space to reconnect with yourself.
So yeah, a lot of people, kind of thinking, let me go to Lynette on it. A lot of people have spoken about this during the lockdown period, Lynette, you know, the idea that perhaps they did have the time to, you know, discover things and aspects of themselves, and to basically, you don't have the commute to work. You won't have the commute to the theatre or to a space to see, to be part of this festival. You could do it from your own bedroom, sitting room, wherever you want to do it. As Karen has described it there, her piece grew when she went onto the digital platform. Are you finding that across other artists, or are you finding other artists who are finding that switch to the digital platform is actually hampering them in some way?
Yeah, I feel like, as you say, obviously it's been a challenging time for everyone in terms of trying to figure out how time exists alongside our regular routine. And in some ways, I've heard lots of people describe time as being elastic, because sometimes it feels like there's lots of it and then it disappears very quickly, particularly during the lockdown period. But I think for artists in particular, there's an opportunity, I suppose, to reimagine work. And I guess what we wanted to avoid doing through the festival was to put any sort of pressure on artists to feel like there was a need to now produce something online. Mm-hmm. So that's specifically why we kind of timed out the festival over the next year and into 2021 across digital and live platforms, because I think it's really important that people have space and time to react to the current situation and to respond and to see how that sits with their work. Because a lot of the work that we're presenting at Live Collision, you know, it's really emotional, political, social, cultural, contextual work. And so artists are, you know, already struggling to kind of present meaningful work in this way in our current climate. So to do that with this added layer of pressure, that there has to be considerations, particularly for me as a curator, around finding the best modes of presentation that support the work as we go through the next couple of months.
And I guess even for some artists, digital literacy might be, there might be certain challenges there. I mean, we can all probably manage our phones and write an email, but you're talking about a whole level, different level of technical ability and technical knowledge when it comes to really creating a piece of art using digital technologies, aren't you?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And likewise for audiences as well. You know, there's a huge assumption that everyone can access digital means, and also an assumption as well that it's a very democratic space. And quite a lot of the time it isn't really. It's a very populated space. There's lots of stuff popping up on people's social media all of the time. And sometimes people are quite overwhelmed by that. So I think it's important that the quality of invitation remains, whether it be a digital invitation or whether it be an invitation to attend a live performance. The quality of that invitation has to be specific.
Well, has to be
there. And that's the bit we're trying to get right. Yeah.
All right. That's Lynette Moran there and Karen Miano, director and artist involved in the Live Collision International Arts Festival. More information on the festival, its programme and the digital initiatives, go to the website livecollision.com. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.